This affinado, played by Stanley Getz, Discord, the theme music for our monthly program, Literary Discord, about books and book publishing and its future, if any. I'm Hans Koning, and today my guest is William Honan of the New York Times. Again, the New York Times, because indeed they are a mighty voice in the land. Bill Honan has been cultural editor in one way or another of the paper for about 15 years. He is not a bookman specifically, and I'm very glad to have him here because I want to ask him how this crisis in book publishing, which is too much attention on the bottom line, only serious novels in very serious trouble, anything that shows a bit of effort and demands a bit of effort is called elitist, which is a dirty word. I asked him to comment on this and, if possible, talk about it as far as it affects other cultural areas in the United States, film, theater, whatever.
Well, I think you put your finger on it. These are not happy times, in my view, in the literary world and in book publishing. I can remember a few years ago we used to say, oh, well, if commercial publishers were preoccupied with bestsellers, the university presses will leap in to publish excellent, thought-provoking books that are becoming spurned by commercial publishers. Well, it was, as you know, it was the leap that never was. The university presses also became preoccupied with the bottom line. Their budgets were slashed, they did not pick up many of the good, important books being written. Furthermore, it became increasingly difficult. I don't know if you've gone into this on your program before, but it's become increasingly difficult to recognize a scholarly book. The scholars are dropping footnotes, because they allegedly turn off readers. Same with bibliography and all of the scholarly apparatus that that many of these books have. So we've also had another major factor that's doing harm to the book publishing industry. It seems to me, is that many university libraries who used to be major customers for scholarly books are now stepping aside from that and not buying those books. The problem is that in the last decade, scholarly journal prices have exploded. A decade ago, you could buy a subscription to a scholarly publication for $30. Today, it's $1,500 or $2,000. Some chemistry textbooks, the annual cost is maybe $6,000. What this has done, it has gobbled up the acquisition budgets of many university libraries, and so they're keeping their journal publications whole and not missing issues, but that at the cost of buying scholarly books. So it's a very difficult situation, not a happy one at all. Some people take a rosy view and say, well, electronic publishing, the internet, and so on, that's going to rescue book publishing. Something has to rescue it because it does embody our national cultural life, our political life to a great degree. So while I hate to be a prophet of doom and gloom, I must say, from where I sit, there's trouble.
This is actually worse than I had dreamt, because I thought that sort of scholarly stuff, I mean medical or whatever, books that they were, that they would be safe because they were serving other purposes. I was worried about basically about a serious novel, of which many people will argue, well, if we have to do without, it's no drama. I think it is a drama, but let me give you something to bite on. For a number of people on this program have come up with Cold Mountain and said that was that showed that there was still a future for a serious book that had not, a serious novel that had not been published with a lot of fanfare and a lot of money.
Yeah.
And just the fact that three or four people mentioned that same book is already a very painful thing to me, because it shows that that any examples of this are obviously very thin on the ground. Moreover,
they all pick the same example.
Yeah, and I must also say, I don't think Cold Mountain is a very, it's a nice page turner, and there's a murder on every page. I don't think it's now exactly a summit of serious literature.
Yeah.
So this is very depressing. The people thought they were being optimistic. Actually, I was greatly depressed. Then there is opera, of course. Many people have a feeling that she's sort of saving literature. Again, to the contrary, I would think that the fact that you need that kind of label to make it is a very bad thing. There are some comparisons outside writing, because I think one of the problems we struggle with is that the critics, music critics are sort of an accepted species, and they know what they, and music is so clearly defined, and even theater and film, you think you can say the same. But for books, there seems to be sort of a anything goes type of policy.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with all that you say, and it is a virus, if we may use that term, that has spread throughout the culture. You're right. It's not just it's not just the book industry. I can give you one example of that that came up just a couple of weeks ago. I came into the office one day a couple of weeks ago, and I was told that someone named Frankie Carl, one of the last of the big band era band leaders, had died out in Arizona. He was 97 years old, and I was asked to write the obituary. And as you know, and I hope most readers of the Times know, we place great store in obituaries. We give them a lot of space and take them seriously, so that our readers can keep up with not only what's coming next, but what was.
Yes.
And so I said, sure, I'll do that obituary. I don't know much about him, but I started doing the thing that we usually do in this kind of situation, and that is send a clerk to the morgue. And in this case, I was confident that he would come back with an armful of thick wad, at any rate, of clips.
Right.
And meanwhile, I started consulting the trade press and learned that Frankie Carl and his orchestra, as it was known, had a radio listening audience in the millions in the late 30s and the early 40s. In fact, the height of his popularity came in 1942 when Eddie Duchin, another very popular band leader of that era, joined the Navy. And he offered Frankie Carl the job of replacing him in his absence.
Right.
And that touched off a bidding war for his services. Frankie Carl was then working for something called Horace Heights Musical Nights. And it was a choice, and that organization began bidding for his services against Eddie Duchin. And finally, the winner was Horace Height, by offering Frankie Carl $1,000 a week and 5% of the gross. Well, those were very big numbers in those days.
Yes.
And it seemed an interesting story. I got to work on it, and the clerk came back empty-handed. There were no clips, no mention of Frankie Carl in previous issues of the New York Times, going way back to the 1930s when he was active. And so it was clear that back then the New York Times did not consider pop fit to print.
I see.
It was just a great cultural shift.
Right.
And now I'm having a little fun with names, and I think comparing or contrasting his coverage, take another Carl or Carly Simons, let's say. We know everything about her. I mean, her clippings, if I'd asked them, I imagine they would rival the clippings on Winston Churchill.
Yes.
You know, we know all about her and her ex-husband, James Taylor, their children, their recording contracts.
More than you ever wanted to know, and I'm not afraid to ask.
Yeah. But so we're just swimming in material. And that was kind of it struck me as a very rather amusing example of the tremendous cultural shift that has taken place over the last generation. And of course the question then becomes, well, is it good or is it bad? And it seems to me that it is good if it means that a once neglected aspect of our culture is being discovered, but it is not so good if it means that attention to pop is crowding out serious discussion of books and authors and certainly the novel and the short story.
Yes.
So we have passed a kind of a crossroads, I guess, in our culture. I don't like to take too elitist a point of view, because I think pop does have a significance. Sometimes it ventures into the world of politics or the sort of things that Bob Dylan was doing and continues to do. So it plays an active role in some respects. But an endless progression of love songs does not make a strong contribution to our culture, I think. And
well, there's certainly room for everything, I would assume. Certainly in the New York Times, there's room for everything.
Well, I don't think so. I think that it's a question of emphasis.
Yes, no, but I mean, technically there's room.
And yeah.
And, well, I think it's terrible that elitism has asserts that it's a dirty word, and that people who are sort of, I mean, I think an education is an extremely important thing now, and we should work on having everybody who presumably wants it get the best education available, rather than make education something which is not something very desirable.
Yeah.
Which is what elitism seems to lead to, that if you use precise four syllable words, you're slightly, they people don't trust you too much. That's really terrible.
Yeah.
Well, there are two, if I may. The New York Times, of course, is sort of in a terribly important item in this war, in the whole situation. The most important one, without doubt, in my mind. There are two things. There is, on one hand, the book review, which I think is excellent in the way that they have resisted this temptation. I may say very briefly a funny sort of story. Michael Wolff, I don't know if you remember that, he wrote and he attacked the book review in his magazine New York, because he thought they didn't make enough of a follow-up on the bestseller list. He didn't realize that the bestseller list was reporting a phenomenon that was not there to promote those books. And he was dumbfounded when Chip McGrath told him that he didn't follow the fate of these books and checked every week how many copies they had sold.
Yeah.
This was very impressive. On the other hand, as a reader, I think that there seems to be too much accent on the business aspect of publishing only, that so much stuff that's in the art pages.
You want to have the intellectual stuff, the aesthetic stuff, that does tend to get swept aside with $1 million contracts and news of...
Which we all know that, first of all, these figures are usually vastly exaggerated.
Yes.
I don't suggest that you don't, but the suit belongs in the business section, or not in the... arts.
Yeah.
But can you reveal something of the thinking behind all this... in at the paper?
Well, I think, I tell you what, I do not sit in those councils anymore, but I can tell you what happened when I was intimately involved with the Culture Report. And that is the, you know, the culture editors then as now were just like you, me, and thee. We recognize the very things that you discussed and that I've touched on, and that is that one can get carried away doing finance. Well, the classic was the, you know, let's do another story about the economics of Broadway. And I suppose the New York, because that's the local industry for one thing, and it is also, that's Shakespeare, that's our cultural life in a very important way. We do think that it's important to say something, to look into the finances of all the different arts. The ballet, the art gallery scene, the museum scene, and so on, all that is important. But those are, in a sense, they're easy stories to do. The tougher ones, the more demanding ones, are sometimes get short shrift, and those are the ones on aesthetics, on different aspects of the content of arts, rather than how much they're being, how much they're priced at. I guess I'm rambling here, but what I'm trying to say is that the people who run the culture department of the New York Times are just like us, and they do recognize that there is a danger in going overboard and invading the territory of the financial department. We don't want to do that. On the other hand, we don't want to neglect that. And when there's a scandal in Hollywood, as there was a few years ago, do you want to? How do you want to play that? How do you want to treat that? Yeah. Do you want to let the culture department's report from Hollywood just be about stars and starlets and directors and their, you know, maybe it would be good to get a little heft and intellectual heft and financial heft and so on into that report. So it's a question of balance and judgment. And also, as we've indicated, the world is changing. It's proper that things should be done differently today than they were 10 years ago.
Of course. But on the other hand, is there a feeling that you, as a newspaper, as the national newspaper, you have a role in counteracting is perhaps too strong a word, but to promote, to be on the side of the good guys, so to speak, or do you feel that a neutral reporting of what's going on is the task?
Well, that's a good question, and it is one that is constantly with us, and I don't mean to dodge it, but I would say that it's a complicated question. Take, for example, the Sunday travel section. Is any story in there supposed to be a recommendation that you go visit and spend your vacation on that little Emerald Isle? Or, in other words, should the travel stories be recommendations? I don't think so. I think in the old days, it was that. And in recent years, we've tried to, and I was travel editor for a period of time, we tried to turn that around and make it a very often highly critical of certain resorts or travel packages or things of that nature. I remember we did a piece once about about black power in the Caribbean, the rise of black power, and how that had changed that part of the world from a tourist point of view. Well, everybody came to everybody in the travel industry came down on us and said that's the wrong thing to do. You ought to be recommend. You ought to be telling us all the wonderful things about the Caribbean. Well, we felt at that time that it was important if there were dangers or if there were changes that people should be aware of. We should report that, and we did. And the same goes for the cultural world. If somebody's chiseling, if somebody's overblown. If somebody's making more money than he or she is worth, we do delve into that very vigorously. Right. And I think that's our place to do it. We should not be a shill for the industry in culture any more than we would be in Defense Department economics.
Since you bring it up, the travel section was much more serious long ago, because I wrote for, not for you, I guess, but many years ago, and one had really very thoughtful articles about the changing world. I'm talking about sort of the 60s and early 70s, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And what period were you thinking of when you were there?
Hans, you've forgotten, but when I was editor of the travel section, I got you to write for it.
Oh, God, I did forget that. Obviously, I can't.
That's why it was so superb and matchless back then.
I see. I can't waste time talking about myself because our time is almost running out. Every film, basically, of any halfway serious film, any halfway serious play is reviewed in the Times, right? How do you deal with this enormous amount of books you get on your desk?
Well, yeah, it's a staggering problem. There are, you hear various numbers. I've heard that there are 30,000 books published in the United States every year, and I've heard that there are 60,000. And maybe the truth lies somewhere in between. But how can we possibly keep up with all of that? The daily book report is usually one book, so that's six or seven books a week. That way, there may be 30 books that are reviewed in the Sunday Book Review times 52. You're going to get a very, very small number. And then, of course, that will be reviewed, and, of course, we generally don't consider cookbooks, many travel books, many coffee table books, many anthologies. There are a lot of things that are excluded to chemistry textbooks, that sort of thing. So the numbers come down, but still we can and we do the best we can, but it's impossible to really,
of course,
say that we're covering everything.
Are the daily reviewers full-time book reviewers?
Yes, they are. That's all they do.
I see.
And
there are three or four or more even.
There are three.
Three
and,
only.
Yeah, and it's quite a demanding job for them, because, as you know, it's also tough. I was thinking, for example, there is a play, it may still be running, called Cellini. It's a play, a stage play, based on the famous autobiography of Benvenuto Cellini.
Right.
And in one of the advances stories about this, it said that the author claimed to have spent 6 years writing that play. The critics, most of them, dismissed it in, 2 hours.
Yeah.
And is that fair? Well,
it's tragic.
It's tragic, you say. Yeah, yeah. It is difficult, but that's the nature of the, in Japan, they don't publish reviews.
Well,
and so maybe we should take a lesson from them and go easy.
It's tragic for the writer. I don't mean to imply that if you work 6 years on something that is necessarily marvelous, unfortunately not. Listen, Bill, you have about 2 more minutes. Can you make a shine your light on the future in general in 50 words, 100 words?
Wow. Well, I think maybe something worth saying is that there should be, thinking about that autobiography of Benvenuto Cellini, maybe we should spend more time, or loads of time, in the creation of our culture. I think another thing that I fear and that disheartens me is that everything is accelerated today, from the internet to email. I think of that fellow, a contemporary of Cellini's, who spent an entire lifetime designing one church door. That, of course, is unthinkable today, but maybe we can go partway in that direction and spend some time improving and uplifting our culture.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.
You have listened to Literary Discord, the book program of WPKN. I am Hans Koning. My guest is Bill Hornan, who has been a cultural editor of the New York Times for many years and who threw some light on the way the problems with publishing, about which we have talked all year, how they reflect on other cultural phenomena in this country. We will be back on April the 26th, the fourth Thursday of April, when our guest will be Susan Sontag. The producer of the program is Scott Harris, and I am Hans Koning.